Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The ones who flourish usually have a parent or an aunt or an uncle or somebody close to them who's encouraging and enabling them. Because if you grow up with no support system for your unusual gift, and it's not recognized in school, and your family doesn't recognize it, or they don't care about it, it may just die out.
On this episode of the Psychology Podcast, I had a chat with the psychologist Ellen Winner about prodigies and gifted children. This was a very meaningful chat for me, considering that Ellen's book, Gifted Children, inspired me so much in college that I credit it as one of the major reasons why I became a psychologist in the first place and decided to study what I do. In this episode, we discuss Ellen's views on IQ and giftedness, the role of parents in talent development, and how the needs of gifted children can best be met. We also discuss a bunch of myths, such as the notion that gifted children are gifted in all subject areas, or the idea that they are all social misfits. Ellen argues for the importance of artistic giftedness, and offers a nuanced understanding of the nature and nurture that causes the, quote, rage to master you see in child prodigies and gifted children. So with great enthusiasm, I bring you Ellen Winner. Ellen Winner. Wow. Thanks for being on the Psychology Podcast today with me.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What a personally meaningful situation this is. Your book, Gifted Children, Realities and Myths in College, is one of the two big books that influenced me. Three books that influenced me to go into this field in the first place. Your book, Howard Gardner's book, Frames of Mind, and Robert Sternberg's book, Successful Intelligence. So those three books, that's why I'm in this field. That's why I do what I do.
That's great.
So thank you for writing that book and for all the amazing research that you've done over the years.
Thank you. How did you
get interested in studying gifted children in the first place?
Children or gifted children?
Gifted children. Oh, maybe. Okay. Did you start off studying all children?
Well, I started off, I'm trained as a developmental psychologist.
Okay.
That came about because before I went to graduate school, I started working at Project Zero. Do you know what Project Zero is?
I sure do. Yes. In college, I was a big fan
okay.
of it. Yes.
At Project Zero, we do research on young children and adults, but I was working with young children doing studies of their understanding of the arts and their ability to make things in the arts, but I wasn't studying gifted children. But that's what got me interested. That's what made me decide to go to get my doctorate in developmental psychology rather than clinical psychology, which I was first going to do. And then and the more I did research on children in the arts and how they develop, I realized that there were huge variations and some children were extremely talented. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me interested in studying children who were very gifted in the arts. But then in the book I wrote, Gifted Children, Myths and Realities, I expanded it to cover giftedness in other areas as well. Music, that's art, of course, visual art, yeah. Reading, mathematics.
Were you an artist yourself?
Yes, I did start out as a child doing a lot of art, and I planned to go to art school, but my parents said, go to college first, a regular college, and then you can go to art school. I obeyed them. I went to college and studied English literature, but then I applied to art school, and I did go to the Museum of Fine Arts School after college in Boston. But after 1 year of it, I decided that this was not for me, because to be an artist is very isolating and very stressful, because it's very hard to actually make it in the arts. And so I decided instead to be a psychologist of the arts.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. Thank God to the field of psychology that you did. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions about these kinds of kids, and I just really want to dispel some of the biggest misconceptions and then talk about what actually is true about them. I think that a lot of people, in their desire, like when they write popular books, that like talent is overrated, those kinds of books, which are very, very popular. I think there's this kind of, they feel like there's this need to make everyone else feel good about themselves by kind of sweeping under the rug the role of talent. It's sort of like, well, you know, their parents pushed them, or, you know, they had all the opportunities in the world. You know, anyone could do it if they had those opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. And I just feel like that's not at the level of nuance that I like to swim in.
So to talk
a little bit about what you actually, what the data actually shows and what you see with your own eyes as well.
Yes. Well, I think this idea that talent doesn't matter got popularized by Anders Ericsson, who wrote about all you need is 10,000 hours of deliberate practice, which means hard work, to become an expert. He didn't actually say to become a genius, but we're child prodigies, and gifted children in the arts are not necessarily geniuses. And then people started saying these children who are prodigies in the arts, they just had 10,000 hours of deliberate practice because they started at a very young age and they worked really hard and it mounts up. And their parents were actually probably pushing them too. So if you actually look at young children who are gifted in the arts or in any area, actually, who are, if you want to call them child prodigies, those are the ones that are extremely gifted. If you look at any of those at a young age, you will see that they are not normal kids. They are not typical kids at all. They obviously have some kind of innate ability in the area in which they are working so hard. And they drive themselves. They have what I call a rage to master. All they want to do is work in their area of expertise. So yes, they get a lot of deliberate practice, but no child is going to do that unless they already have a strong ability and therefore love of working in this particular domain.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, you look at you just look at like even sports stars, like you look at Kobe Bryant, who I went to middle school and high school with, and I, you know, you see they had this rage to master. And you know, it takes you know, practice matters, but not everyone gets the same bang for their buck out of the same training regimen.
That's the other thing is you have to know how to like, practice. Yeah. Right. So I really discount that claim. I think it's completely wrong, and I've written a lot about how that's a myth that really should be dispelled. I think it also comes out of a desire not to be elitist. Everybody can get there.
Yeah.
It sounds nice, but it just is not true.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you've probably been following, a lot of gifted programs are being cut in the name of equity right now.
Right.
Have you seen that?
Yes, of course.
And what are your thoughts on that situation?
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate because children who are gifted, the more gifted they are, the more difficulty they have in the regular classroom because they are way above their age peers and they can't find anybody else like themselves. So parents have a real problem because schools are meant for the typical child. Our schools are not designed to take care of the extremes at either end.
So true.
So one thing parents sometimes do is grade skip their children, but that used to be more popular earlier, and now it's frowned upon because people think that the child who's grade skipped will have social problems. Another tip, most often what schools do is they provide a pullout gifted and talented program where kids get pulled out of the regular classroom maybe once a week, and they are with other kids that are identified as gifted in whatever area, all different areas may participate, and they work on projects that probably all kids could benefit from. And then they go right back to the regular classroom where if they're like 5 years ahead in math, they're still doing boring math. Another possibility is individual education programs that get worked out for each child. And I think that has a lot of promise. Ideally, it would be great if we could have, in high school, we have advanced classes in different areas and kids can select into them, AP classes, for instance. I think it would be fine to have advanced classes, even in elementary school. But, you know, let children self-select into them because you can be sure that kids who don't feel very competent at math or reading or writing are not going to self-select into a class that makes huge demands on them. So I think that I'm not in favor of testing kids to see if they get in because I think that that creates stress. Let them self-select. If they can't handle the work, they have to get counseled out. I didn't say canceled. Yeah. Counseled out.
Gotcha. Yeah. In your experience, how much are over-involved parents involved with gifted children?
It really varies. Some parents who try to put their child on the public stage, if they're a music performer, for instance, some parents want them to perform at a very early age. Other parents don't do that. And I do think it's a mistake for parents to push too hard. Because I think parents should encourage and enable, but not push too hard, because it does create a problem. Because the child, let's take a child who's performing doing a solo performance in an orchestra, in front of the orchestra, you know, or just alone. That child is going to get a huge amount of adulation for what he or she is doing. And when they grow up, if they're going to continue to be considered exceptional, they're going to have to do something original and new in the way they perform, for instance, to be considered unusual. And because otherwise a lot of other, say, musicians will have caught up with them, even if they weren't prodigies as children. And I think this creates a real wound in the child that they were so special and now they're not special anymore. And that actually leads to the issue of whether child prodigies become great domain-changing artists. You can ask that question of prodigies in any area, and that's something we could talk about if you want.
Well, you know I do.
Okay.
What do the stats show? Are there some domains where the conversion is more likely?
I don't actually have quantitative data on this. I can tell you that if you look at adults who are at the highest end of, say, mathematics or writing literature or visual art or things that involve math like science, some of them were child prodigies. But majority of them were not. And so it's not necessary to be a child prodigy to be a really creative person in your domain. Most child prodigies end up being experts. So, for instance, a math prodigy might end up being a math professor but not a mathematician making original discoveries. Mm-hmm. And there's really no reason why we should expect prodigies to become major creators, because there are very few major creators. There are not that many prodigies, but there are a lot more prodigies than there are major creators. So it's very hard to make the leap, because a child prodigy is mastering a domain that's already been given to them, like classical music or mathematics. But to be a major creator, you have to invent something. And that's not the same skill as being a prodigy.
No, that's a very good point. In investigating, for my book Ungifted, and when I investigated savants and prodigies and other high forms of talent that seem to appear out of nowhere, I try to really get to the bottom of it and really just understand, like, where does giftedness come from, you know? And it does seem like there's a lot of what I call implicit learning involved. There's a lot of soaking up of regularities and patterns. A lot of these domains that you're referring to have repeated regularities, and that we have an implicit learning system that evolved.
I would agree with that. I mean, performers in classical music, or math prodigies, or drawing giftedness, is all these children are operating in a well-structured domain. And I can say that for drawing giftedness, because kids who are prodigious in drawing, they're drawing super realistically. There are very few that draw non-representationally that we would consider prodigies. There are a few, but these are well-structured domains. And so, yes, I think these kids do pick things up easily. In fact, I say they learn differently from their peers because they really teach themselves. They don't need to be explicitly taught very much. You know, I studied one child who learned to read at 2. And the way he learned to read was he asked his mother to read him the same book every day for 1 week, pointing to the words as she read. And then he chose another book and they went through the same routine. And after that, he had just cracked the code of reading. That's implicit learning. But if you take an ill-structured domain like biology,
creative
or medicine, or writing novels, you really don't find prodigies in these ill-structured domains. It takes a long time or composing even, composing music. It takes, that comes later.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guess what, Mango? What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I'm just, I wish we really could wrap our heads around more about the role of genetics in this stuff, because I don't think the heritability twin studies tell us much about the mechanism involved. It just tells us that there is a heritability coefficient, but I want something deeper. I want to know the mechanism by which proteins that are coded can somehow, through gene expression, cause such high levels of expertise, which are not directly encoded in the genes. There's no genetic blueprint for some of these evolutionarily novel things that these prodigies are learning. Right. that never operated on evolutionary timescale. You know what I mean?
I'm not sure that we could answer that question for the genetics of anything, except perhaps a disease.
Right.
But something very specific. I mean, do we know the mechanisms by which genetics affects intelligence? You know, the biochemical mechanisms?
All we know is that many, many interacting genes are involved. That's all we know.
Yes, exactly. Right. But anybody that says there's no genetics involved in extremely gifted kids is just fooling themselves, because there has to be an innate component.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not all of these children have first degree relatives who have that kind of talent, but they often do. One child that I'm studying right now who's very gifted in drawing, neither of his parents draw, but he has a grandfather who became an architect. And I spoke to the grandfather and he said he drew precociously, realistically, at a very early age. So
that's something that stuck out for me when I read David Henry Feldman's book on prodigies. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you and him have talked before.
Yes.
And he's such a great guy as a human as well, as a researcher. But in his book, that really stuck out to me, that a lot of these prodigies did have someone going back even far enough where you say, right, the great, 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 great grandfather.
Yes. And also, to get to the non-genetic part, the ones who flourish usually have a parent or an aunt or an uncle or somebody close to them who's encouraging and enabling them. Because if you grow up with no support system for your unusual gift, and it's not recognized in school, and your family doesn't recognize it, or they don't care about it, it may just die out. I remember in my son's school, when he was growing up, there was a child prodigy, I thought, in drawing. He was just amazing. And I told his father that, and he said, I'm not interested. He was an immigrant from Haiti. And the father said, I'm not interested in his drawing. I want to know how he does in math. I could understand his point. He wanted his son to grow up and earn a living. But I don't know what happened to that child. But that's the kind of child who may just stop drawing because it's not encouraged.
That's a bit heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Whenever anyone has a passion, whatever age. Yeah.
Some people overcome their parent. Leonard Bernstein, supposedly, his parents wanted him, his father wanted him to go into some business that he wasn't in the slightest interested in, and he just did what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But he's not your average adult who used to be a child prodigy, though I'm sure he was a prodigy. He's one of the select few. You have to have a certain personality to make the leap from prodigy to creator. You have to be very strong-willed and really have a desire to shake things up and to do something new. And that's a kind of personality characteristic.
Yeah, that's an additional source of genetic variation that you add that into the interacting mix.
Right.
Let's just think this through for a second. So, is there a benefit to, because you can kick off that rage to master process at any age in your life. I want to start with that postulate. So you can be 70 years old and suddenly become captivated by something. It seems to me what happens with a lot of these prodigies is that, you know, while other 2-year-olds are out there trying to, you know, like screaming and trying to get food and water, there are some 2-year-olds who are trying to consume books and like water, you know, and that is, so that's what is anomalous about prodigies, but they still are starting, you know, they're starting the mastery process like anyone would start the mastery process who has maybe a little bit of a knack for something. Is there a benefit? So I'm now going to actually ask my question. Is there a benefit with what we know about, you know, narrow periods where we can soak up knowledge at certain ages easier than other ages? Does that help explain a little bit why starting with that rage to master at a very, very young age might bring better long-term dividends than when you start later in life?
Well, of course, I can't answer that question scientifically, but I can just speculate that there's something very special about the young child's mind and the way the young child, typical or gifted, learns so effortlessly and rapidly. Think of how children learn language. Mm-hmm. So I think when a child is showing a rage to master at a very early age, they're consuming a huge amount of information and processing it in their minds, and it may well lead to them being better eventually in their domain than somebody who starts doing this in adulthood. I mean, of course, or in late adulthood. And of course, the child has the benefit of all the years ahead of that child. Whereas if you start something late, you have less time to develop that talent.
Well, that's assuming that you live a long life.
Yes.
You know, everything's just, I feel like everything's kind of like up to luck.
There's a lot of luck involved. A lot of luck in the genetic
and
combination and environmental. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things David Feldman talks about, is the co-occurrence of many things that lead to a child prodigy.
That's right. Well, how important is that co-occurrence of IQ? I know that's a very contentious topic and one which have you heard of Howard Gardner's work? I'm joking.
Do you know what? Oh, you know he's my husband.
I know. I'm joking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was going to say, have you heard of your husband's work? But then I thought I'd say it. You know, so he's, you know, obviously done a lot of work trying to expand our notions of what intelligence means. But I think he would admit that he's often misunderstood. His theory is often misunderstood.
Yes,
you know, he expanded multiple intelligences, but still each of those intelligences have their own giftedness and talent associated
with
them. There's still individual differences. It's just amazing to me how people take his theory like it meant, therefore, we all can be geniuses.
Exactly. Or all children are gifted.
Right.
And he never said that.
He never said that. I get it. I get him. And I understand his theory. So in your own work with prodigies, to what extent do you really see that multiple intelligences play out, you know, with your own eyes?
Well, I think if you look at the domains where we see prodigies, they constitute some of the intelligence. There's logical, mathematical, we see mathematical prodigies. There's linguistic, and we see kids who speak early and read early. There's musical, and we see that. There's visual spatial, and that, I think I would put our visual art prodigies in there.
Yeah.
What about the other intelligences? Do we find prodigies there? People haven't really reported prodigies in interpersonal, like understanding other people, or intrapersonal, like understanding yourself. Those may be harder to detect. And there's no reason to think that they're, I mean, I know some children are precocious in empathy. I heard about one child who used to cry when people were in her family were sad because she was so, or she cried from sad music because she was so overwhelmed by other people's sadness. Mm. You know, that could be some kind of interpersonal intelligence.
Right.
And as for naturalism, you know, the naturalist intelligence, probably Charles Darwin was a prodigy in naturalist intelligence. He went around collecting beetles of all kinds and was fascinated with them. But we don't really hear reports of kids in these less structured domains. And that doesn't mean they're not out there. Hmm. We just don't, haven't had reports of them. Now, there is a myth that a gifted child is gifted in everything. And that does actually go against the idea of multiple intelligences, which argues that these intelligences are separate from one another. That doesn't mean you can't have all of them and be at a high level. It just means that you can also have just one and not be at a high level in others. And so that comes out back to the question of IQ. In the visual arts, there are several pieces of data showing that kids who and adults too, who are visual artists, do not have above average intelligences. Of course, some do, but on average, they don't.
You mean IQ?
Yeah, IQ.
When you say intelligence, I know.
Yeah, sorry, the word IQ. Thanks for correcting me.
Yeah, no
if
problem.
You remember the if you think about savants who are low in IQ and also autistic. They can do amazing things in visual arts and in memory and in music. And people like to say, well, they're just like machines. They're not creative. But there have been some studies showing that actually musical savants they're improvising. They can improvise. They're not just machines. Clearly, these kinds of talents can exist without a high IQ. Now, as for math and verbal and linguistic intelligences, well, those are really part of the IQ test. So I doubt you might have a savant prodigy in math who doesn't have a high IQ, but what savant prodigies do is calculation. That's a very narrow area of mathematics. But if you have a child that's really good at grasping mathematical concepts, it's likely that that child will have a higher than average IQ, since IQ involves numerical reasoning. So I think it depends on the domain. There's a lot of controversy about music too, whether musically gifted children have a higher than average IQ. There's some evidence, yes, but there's also some evidence that in children who are have a high IQ tend to gravitate to music. Maybe they like the structured part of it. But we don't know anything about kids who are musically talented in rock and roll or garage bands. So it may be that kids who want to do classical music, maybe that those kids come to it because they have a high IQ or it's correlated with it. But we can't just say musical giftedness is correlated with a higher IQ because we've only studied one kind of musical giftedness, which is classical music performance.
Why do people get so fixated on IQ? I think there's this kind of thought that, well, anything that's not IQ is learnable, whereas IQ is fixed. But that's not true. you're shit out of luck if you don't have the arts gene as well.
And also, IQ is somewhat learnable because we know that IQ scores have gone up over the decades.
Right. Right. That's true, too.
The Flynn effect. And we know that children's IQ drops after their summer vacation and has to go back up again during school. So there certainly are environmental influences.
That's right. There are both biological and environmental influences on everything, on every psychological trait. Get over it. People, get over it already. Move on.
Right.
It's just people got so fixated on IQ. So I'm really glad that you know, I'm just going down this list of realities and myths, and you're really organically covering so many of them. So thank you. One that I think a lot of people think about when they think about gifted children is they think of them as psychological and social misfits.
Oh.
What has been your own experience in working with these kinds of kids?
I think that I would make a distinction between moderately gifted and severely gifted. The more extreme the gift, the more social problems the child has. But it's not because the child is gifted. It's because the child is so alone. Because there's not others like that child for that child to associate with. And so I think if that child were in a class of other kids just as gifted, they wouldn't have problems. I think the problem comes because there's so few like you. And I always say to parents, the most important thing you can do for your child is find, if you have a prodigy, is to find at least one other child like your child so they don't feel so isolated.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guess what, Bango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There was a researcher, her last name was Hollingsworth.
Yes.
Who really, yes, she talked, she wrote, above 180 IQ, kind of children she studied, and she found that a lot of their social awkwardness disappeared when she allowed them to kind of talk to each other. Now, I think that, like, on the one hand, this could be kind of like an excuse for my awkwardness, but I also think we need to also be careful to not get into that mindset where, like, oh, the reason why I feel awkward around ordinary civilians is because they're just not at my level of intelligence. Now, I don't want to get into that mindset. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So how can we raise these kids by being honest about, you know, wow, there is a certain, you know, it's really good to be around like-minded and
right.
really like-minded, you know, literally, yeah. literally like-minded people. But also to not look down on others, not think that because you have a particularly high IQ that you're better than others.
Right.
These seem to be lessons that we should instill in these children. Do you agree?
Yes. And I think that's why I don't particularly like the label gifted or prodigy to be used with the child. Hmm. I think it's much, because that can lead to feelings that they're better than other people. Mm. I would just say you're really good at this and you really love this. And other people yeah. are good at other things. But if your child is feeling, like bullied because he's so different, or just lonely because he doesn't have anybody to talk to because nobody's on his wavelength, mm-hmm. that's when I say to parents, try to find one other child. Now, with the internet, there are all kinds of more opportunities, but it's not the same as face-to-face. You can't have play dates. But I would say that as kids get older, the problem is lessened, because when you go to high school, there are more opportunities to take advanced classes, and you might find other kids in those classes. And certainly when you go to college, people self-select into colleges, which are which some colleges demand extremely high ability. So if you go to, MIT or Harvard or Princeton or Yale or Stanford, you're going to find other, not that everybody there is like that, but you're certainly going to find more atypical kids at the high end. And therefore, you're less likely to be alone. But in kindergarten and in elementary school, it can be really difficult.
Well, it sounds to me like you advocate an acceleration grade skipping program above a pull-out classroom gifted program. Is that yes. fair?
Yeah, I think the pull-out program is like a Band-Aid. It may be nice because kids meet other kids who are gifted, but they might not be gifted in the same area. So it might be good socially. But I don't think it's going to help their boredom in school. So I would ideally, it would be great if there could be, instead of grade skipping, there could be domain specific skipping, so that in, let's say you have a math whiz, why can't that child go to, during regular math class, go up to the math class of kids 3 years older? Of course, schools have to be organized for this so that they have vertical organization of classes so that all the math classes are at the same time. I think that would be a nice solution. I think that would be much better than taking a child and putting them in a grade 3 or 4 years older in all areas. I do know of several children whose parents have managed to figure that out, and the kids were in a school which had an elementary school and a middle school and a high school on three different campuses. This child was bused to the high school for math class and then bused back when he was in elementary and middle school.
Well, I agree about pull-out programs. I think often there's more money that school districts spend on identification than programming. And they get to the yes. point where they spend 99% of their money for finding the right IQ test, and then they just stick them all together and say, go be gifted.
Right.
And that doesn't seem very promising. I also like the idea of elevating the standards for everyone.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with
everyone? I think it's great. It's just pie in the sky. But that's the first thing I would say, and I do say this in my book, elevate the standards for everybody, expect more. And then kids who are just moderately gifted, they may be 1 or 2 years in advance, maybe they'll be just fine. They won't be bored. But so you still have the issue for the extremes. And by the way, even in schools for the gifted, and I studied one school in California called the Nueva School, and I wrote about that in my book. Even there, parents of the extreme gifted complained that there were too many moderately gifted kids and their kid was still too extreme and they were still bored in school. And when you have that problem, then I think you have to be flexible and give that child more advanced work. Individual yeah. educational programs worked out for individual children.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. It just seems like at the end of the day, we're just talking about helping all children self-actualize in their own way.
Yes.
And to the best of their potential. Exactly. And I kind of like that framing a little bit better. That's how I kind of frame it. I'm not in love with these labels like moderately gifted.
I know.
Exemplarily gifted. What is it?
Severely.
Severe, it sounds like a disease. severely makes it sound like a disease.
I know.
Severely, you know, gifted. Because giftedness is not an essence, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not an essence of a person. No. It's a characteristic of a human. You know, they're humans first.
Yes.
Not and gifted first.
It's a continuum. Yeah. It's a continuum, you know?
Yeah.
From typical to more and more and more gifted. And, you know, where's the cutoff for a prodigy? You know, David Feldman says it's when they can do adult work by age 13 or below. Mm. That's his cutoff. I don't really care whether we classify a child as a prodigy or an almost prodigy. I think we just have to think of this as a continuum. And if children are not getting adequately stimulated in school, something needs to be done because we don't want them to get bored and turned off of school. And I know a child right now who's in second grade who's experiencing that. And
completely.
I worry about it.
I worry about that a lot too. And I worry about the pressure to achieve that these kids feel and the shame they may feel.
That's right. And that's why I don't think it's a good idea for parents to put their kids on the public stage, whether it's performing music or being on spelling bee programs or whiz kid programs on TV. I just do not think this is good for children. It's stressful and it may make them feel they're better than others.
Yeah.
And it may make them feel like that's what their parents love them for and nothing else.
Mm, that's a great point. That's a really, really, truly great point. It's almost like there's this sense that a lot of these kids feel like the only reason why they have worth in this world is because of their talent.
Right. Exactly. And that they should stay in that area as they grow up because they have to kind of make a commitment to it. And that's not fair either. They may well want to go into something completely different.
Mm, absolutely.
I mean, one of the kids that I studied in my book, was a math prodigy. I called him Number Boy because he called himself that. He's now in law school.
Hmm. Can you be accomplished? Not even accomplished, but can you become gifted? I'm not saying prodigies because I understand prodigies has a specific age limit. You can't be a 50-year-old prodigy. I get that. But can you be 50-year-old and suddenly become gifted at something?
Well, maybe you didn't realize that you had a gift in some area and then you find that area and you find that you're gifted in it. I think it's, I don't believe that you can work in music all your life and then suddenly become and not be more than typical and then suddenly at age 50 become gifted in music.
Okay.
Because I do think of gifted as part of you. It's not something you said. It's not an essence. But what is it? What would it even mean to say you become gifted if we're saying that giftedness has a genetic component? A biological component, at least.
Well, the way that it's often presented in these talent is overrated books is these best-selling books, you know, like Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, et cetera.
Right.
The way that they view this situation is that what – this is what they'll say. They'll say what appears like some innate talent is really so many years of hard work and that what you don't see is all the – boring tasks that they do and all the hard work they do. So that's their narrative they're putting forward about the situation. That's what I mean.
Right. And what I'm saying is that any typical child is not going to work that hard. I mean, what typical child is going to sit down at the piano and practice for 4 hours a day?
Well, even adults. I'm talking about adults too. Yeah. 50-year-olds. I'm talking about adults as well, like 50-year-olds.
Yeah. Okay. What typical adult is going to do that? You have to experience that it has to come easily to you and you have to get flow from it. And if it's not something that you're particularly good at, you can work at it, But I think working hard without talent is not going to get you that far. In my book, I have a child who drew trains obsessively as a very young child, pre-K, and his trains did get better, but they were nothing on the level of what child prodigies in art do. So I think it's just. That's, you can work hard at things, but you're not going to get to the level. You're not going to get to be a yo-yo Ma not just by working hard. You've got to have some kind of proclivity to music.
Biological. Mic drop. That's an expression they use to say you drop the mic. You have the last word on the situation.
Does that mean you want me to turn the mic off?
No. There's an expression.
Oh, okay.
Like Obama's last speech. He did his mic drop. He said his last thing that was amazing.
Oh, okay. And then I get it now.
Drop the mic, Ellen. Okay.
Okay. I like being compared to Obama, of course.
Well, so that is amazing what you just said, and so profound, because that really isn't the majority narrative. That really isn't the majority narrative. Now, but I will say this, I'm sure you'll agree. It's possible to have the absorption and interest, not have the talent, and that can still carry you pretty far. Now, maybe there are limits on how far that can take you, but you know, I've recently gotten into magic, I've gone down the rabbit hole, and I don't know if I have a talent for it. I don't know, but I tell you, I love it, and I just get in the flow state by trying to master all sorts of methods that I'm learning.
Well, so, you know, we don't know anything about prodigies in magic, but I would guess that if you're really drawn to it and you're working hard at it, and it's of course all self-driven, no teacher is giving you this as an assignment, you probably do have a talent. I'm not sure what intelligences it takes to be a good magician, but certainly interpersonal would have to be very important, because you have to be able to fool people. And maybe spatial, because you have to be very deft with your hands.
Psychology too.
Yes. Right. Yeah. You have to, but that's what I meant by interpersonally. You have to kind of understand other people's minds and understand how you want them to believe what you're doing.
Right. That's right. Yeah. I'm a mentalist, which is a form of magic where you read people's minds.
Oh.
It's called mentalism. I love it.
Oh. You
pretend,
you get people to believe you're reading their minds.
right.
Or you really do read their minds.
I think it's a combination.
Uh-huh. Well, you have to pay very careful attention to little subtle cues, leakages in their face, you know, leakages of their, if they're tapping their foot very quickly while they're smiling, you might think that's a sign that's leaking out of them that shows they're really stressed.
That's right. That's exactly right. But back to you here. You've written two additional books about arts education. And art and the psychology of art. One is called An Uneasy Guest in the Schoolhouse, Art Education from Colonial Times to a Promising Future, and How Art Works, A Psychological Exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Studio
Thinking.
Okay, studio. Amazing. Well, your body of work is incredible. What makes something art? what a question that is, right?
That's
what
are the boundaries? Chapter.
I know.
It's my first chapter in How Art Works, and that is that basically don't confuse the question of what is art with what is good art. If I put it in a museum, it is functioning as art. You may think it's junk, but it is called art. So whatever art is, it's something that we set aside and put it in a special place and ask people to respond to it. And it's a socially constructed category. You know, it's not like tree, which is a biological category. It's something that humans have constructed.
Well, yes. I mean, there's so many thousands of years where all we had were aesthetic hand axes that got more and more aesthetic. But it didn't dawn on, until culture was created, it didn't dawn on us we could do more with our creativity than more ornamental hand axes.
Well, don't forget the cave paintings.
That's true. That came a little bit later, but no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yes. Cave paintings.
And also that cave paintings show our human drive for significance, because you see a lot of people, you know, that you see they're signing their names in the way that they have at the time,
right.
You know, trying to get some posterity, you know, so there's also that drive that's shown in the paintings.
But are you saying the cave paintings were signed?
Well, what you do see are handprints.
Yes. And is that sometimes considered the artist's signature?
That's the way I personally, that's why I said in their own way, you know, signed in their own, and whatever uh-huh. that meant in there. That I think that's the drive that humans uh-huh. were trying to get out. You know, like the Chauvelin cave, you know, they found all these.
Yes, I've seen those.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people have debated the function of those cave paintings for a long time, and I don't think we're ever going to know. Is it to inspire people right. to go out for the hunt?
That's
is
true.
It to make themselves admired so they'll get a mate? You know, that's what an evolutionary psychologist might say. So we can speculate.
That's
but
right,
certainly yeah. the artistic urge was there from the very beginning of being human.
Yeah, that's for sure. Why do we seek out and even cherish sorrow and fear from art when we don't go out of our right. way to experience those things in real life?
Yeah, that's a very puzzling question psychologically and philosophically, but we certainly do. So we can look at a painting depicting war, like Guernica by Picasso, and think this is powerful and even beautiful. And it makes us also confront the sadness in the painting, but we don't mind doing that. And, you know, Winfried Menninghaus has written about this he was the former head of the Max Planck Institute in Germany. We put an aesthetic frame around it. So it's not happening to us. So there's a certain distancing, aesthetic distancing. And so we can savor these emotions, these negative emotions, because we know that they exist. They exist in our lives personally. And so we want to understand them. And we can find beauty in the formal properties of the arts that convey sadness. Plenty of very beautiful, sad music that makes you feel sad, but it also is beautiful. So I think it's it's the concept of being moved. We really like to feel moved. And we get moved particularly by sad art, by tragic art, because it's so strong and it gives us a feeling of meaning and understanding. It's kind of surprising that humans will pay money to feel sad.
Absolutely.
Or to even feel horror.
Absolutely.
You might feel horror by looking at Guernica.
Well,
but you run away from that in your own life because it's not distanced. It's happening to you.
That's true. Does art help us increase our empathy towards others that are very different from ourselves?
That's a really interesting question, and it's a very feel-good claim that art makes us more empathetic. I'm skeptical, though I have one study showing something very specific in that area, but I'm skeptical because there's so many examples of people who are not empathetic who understood art and loved art, and the best example is the Nazis. They loved art. They collected it, and they listened to classical music, and they loved Wagner. And yet, look what they showed, no empathy. So my feeling, what the study that I did on this, I said, I think we have to look at a specific kind of art about a specific issue, and it might lead to empathy. So what we looked at were a story about immigrants who had been brought over as children and who were not did not have citizenship, and they were living in huge amount of stress. And we wanted to find out whether people who read that book, as opposed to newspaper clippings about the plight of immigrants, whether the book people would actually change their attitudes towards undocumented immigrants in a more empathetic direction.
Wow.
And we were able to show that. But I We did not show that it changed their behavior because we couldn't test their behavior. All we showed is it changed their attitudes, and that lasted for several months because we tested them again, and their attitudes remained changed. But that doesn't mean that art in general can do this. It may be specific to narrative art about a specific issue, and maybe it can change your mind about that issue. But I think it's very, very difficult to change people's minds toward and make them more empathetic by a one-shot thing. There has to be a long process, and it probably has to involve talking and discussing with the, say, children who are being shown artworks. There's no good evidence that looking at works of art improves people's empathy. Works of visual art or listening to sad music improves their empathy, those kind of general empathy. The only thing I can pinpoint is attitude change in the direction of empathy if the artwork is connected to that attitude change.
Well, I really appreciate that honesty. But that makes a lot of common sense as well. You know, context matters is basically what you're saying.
Right.
Is art making therapeutic? What do you think of art? I mean, art therapy is a whole business.
Yeah. And there is quite a bit of evidence on that. And I know you know Jen Drake.
Definitely.
Her work has shown that making art, even very simple, making a simple drawing, improves mood into a more positive direction, whether it's children or adults. And that may be part of the basis of art therapy. Of course, art therapy is different because it involves a therapist who's talking to you about your art and interpreting it. And but what Jen has shown is simply making art improves mood for at least some amount of time. And that seems... It improves well-being. She also showed that people have turned to the arts during the COVID pandemic. And I think that certainly tells you something about people trying to find comfort.
I'm still getting a little hung up on what art is and what art isn't. What isn't art? What isn't art? Why is science not art?
Okay. What isn't art? This glass here, if I put this in a museum and gave it a title, like glass half full or whatever, yes, that's art. You may think it's of no interest at all, but it is art. But by itself, it's just an object. Now, Nelson Goodman, who was the founder of Project Zero, was very interested in the difference between symbols used in the arts and symbols used in science. And he said, you could take the same zigzag line and in the context of a cardiograph, that would be a scientific symbol. But if you take that same line and put a frame around it and put it in a museum, people start attending to certain features that they didn't attend to in the scientific graph. They attend to the color of the line, the texture, whether there are any variations in thickness. So he called that repleteness, that the symbol becomes replete when we think of it as art, but we look right through it when they think of it as science because we're not interested in the texture of the line. We could translate that graph into numbers and get exactly the same information.
I see. I think I get it. Science can be art then. I mean, data itself can be art in the right context, in the right presentation, I should say, in the right presentation of it.
You mean if you put your scatter plot in a museum?
Yes.
Yes. The argument is that then people will actually look at it differently and they will start to perceive properties that were not important.
Got it.
When they were looking at it as just a plain scatter plot.
Got it. Thank you for giving me the clearest answer to that question of why is science not art anyone's ever given to me in my entire life. So thank you. And why is that important? Why is art important in schools? Why are they cutting arts programs? And what are your thoughts on what we should be doing about that in schools?
Well, of course, I think that's a very sad thing that we're cutting art in schools or that they're always the first thing to be cut when there's a budget crunch. because art is important for people's well-being. And I think it's, there are all kinds of reasons. One, it's important for students' well-being. Two, students might be talented in an art form and never know it, and may not be good in academic subjects. And if there's art in school, they may discover their talent and realize that they could go on in a career somehow related to visual art or music. And the other reason is that art is a fundamental part of being human. And if kids in school should be, I think that schools should be teaching kids about the most important things that humans have ever done. And that includes science, but it also includes the arts. And if you leave that out, I think they're getting a lopsided education.
Yeah.
It's it's probably the only area in school where they're doing something which doesn't have right and wrong answers.
Divergent thinking.
Yeah.
Gosh forbid.
Now, not all art education is creative. There's some very bad art education. And in our several books called Studio Thinking, where we do have new editions of them, but we called it Studio Thinking, The Real Value of Visual Art Education. And we studied the best teachers in visual, very strong teachers in visual art. And we found that these teachers were teaching their kids artistic dispositions or artistic ways of thinking, learning to look really carefully, learning to express themselves, learning to reflect on what they're doing and take criticism and revise. Very important thinking dispositions that can be taught in strong arts education programs. And it may well be that those skills transfer to other domains, like you may become a better observer in science if you learn to observe closely in art. But that should never be the justification for having art classes, because art should be considered important in itself. We don't talk about the value of math because it might transfer to understanding musical scales. We just assume that math is important on its own.
Love that. Well, you make a good case for why we shouldn't cut these programs in schools, and concomitantly, I don't think I just invented that word, concomitantly, but I don't think it's a word. But anyway, similarly, along similar lines, we shouldn't cut gifted programs for similar reasons.
Yep.
Because we have a lot of kids who are going to be, even if they don't become the most high achieving artists in the world, they still are going to contribute great things to culture and even to their own lives.
In art class, I would say that in art class, you may not need a gifted art class because kids work at their own pace in art class.
Cool. Good point.
So, yeah.
Good point. I was just trying to tie everything up in a neat bow at the end of this interview.
Okay.
Why? Let's not cut gifted. You will agree, though. Let's not cut arts programs. Let's not cut gifted programs.
Absolutely. But I think most parents would say, yeah, let's not cut art programs. But if you say to them, would you rather have art classes cut or would you rather have math classes cut? They'll say math. I'd rather have the art classes cut. But generally, there's public approval of keeping art in our schools. But the idea of gifted programs is very controversial because people worry that it's keeping out minorities. And unfortunately, that may sometimes happen. So we have to search hard for kids from underrepresented groups to be put into these programs. But it's an unpopular view because it's maybe considered elitist.
Right. The answer is to expand the search, not limit.
Yes.
Limit excellence.
Exactly.
Ellen Winter, thank you so much for being on my show today and for the legendary work that you've done in the field and for personally inspiring me to do what I do.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
You ask great questions.
Thank you. Glad we finally got this one in the can.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.